Well, thanks everybody for getting up bright and early for the climate change session this morning. I'm John Upton. I'm a journalist, reporter, editor at Climate Central, excuse me, which is an organization that does scientific research as well as journalism. And I am excited to have these panelists here this morning. We have Andrea Thompson, an editor at Scientific American, who has a lot of real science journalism experience, particularly when it comes to extreme weather. Alexander Kaufman is a reporter at the Huffington Post. He has extensive daily news reporting experience. And Justine Kalmer, a reporter at Grist, who covers environmental justice. And the point of today's session really is just to talk about how do you incorporate climate change and climate science into your coverage when you're not writing a climate change story per se. Well, what's the appropriate way to do that? What's the best way to handle that? And recently, there's been a lot of advances in the last maybe 5 years. Scientists have come a long way in terms of developing new methodologies for attributing climate change, the role of climate change in extreme weather events. So I'd love if Andrea could kick off this morning by just explaining a little bit about extreme event attribution and just introduce yourself.
Yeah, so I'm Andrea Thompson. I'm the editor, associate editor for sustainability at Scientific American, which is, includes climate change, among many, many other things. So I actually am a former co-worker of John's at Climate Central, which did a lot of attribution work. So it kind of used to be, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, the standard phrase was, from any climate scientist you talk to about a hurricane, a heat wave, anything like that, was, well, we can't attribute, you know, we can't say what climate role climate change played in any individual event, but we can say that this is the type of event we expect to see more of in the future. And that has really evolved since about 2004, when Peter Stott at the UK Met Office kind of did the first attribution study, which was on the 2003 European heat wave, which killed, you know, thousands of people. And he actually showed, you know, we can find climate change fingerprints on some of these, on some of these extreme weather events. And that has really kicked off a field that has just exploded in the last decade. And it's gotten to the point now where there are some even real-time kind of attribution analyses that are done, you know, within a couple weeks of an event. The effort, the idea being that you can kind of say something about the role of climate change while the news cycle for that, that event is still, you know, going on, versus most of the studies that have been done were kind of, you know, a year or two later, so when people may not be talking about that event anymore. There's even recently a group of scientists did an attribution study on the forecast for Hurricane Florence. So they compared, you know, what you would expect with and without climate change given the forecast of Florence. So that was kind of the latest sort of update in attribution science. So the idea is that there's kind of a couple ways that attribution science is done. You can look at the observations for an event, so a heat wave, and see how that has changed over time. But you need a long record for that to be able to say anything with any kind of certainty of how things, to look for those trends. And you don't always have that depending on where you're talking about or what kind of measurement you're making. Temperature is kind of the easiest, so that's why a lot of attribution involves heat waves. It's also much more, heat waves are much more easily tied to global warming. You can also do it with models where you basically, you have the model that includes climate change and the model removing that signal, and you see how the frequency or intensity of an event changes between those two. And those are kind of the two measures that attribution looks at, intensity, frequency. Frequency, likelihood, yeah. And that's one of the key things that a lot of scientists who do attribution work will say is, you know, the question that often gets asked is, did climate change cause this event? But that's kind of the wrong question, and that's not really a question science can answer per se. So you have to be much more precise with the question you're asking, so and how you define your event. That's a big thing for them. So the example being, you know, Hurricane Harvey, which an analysis was done last year, and they specifically looked at, you know, the rainfall. Now, the models kind of take into account a lot of different elements that would have affected the rainfall, but, you know, they they specified, you know, a certain day period of rainfall, and that's what they kind of looked at in the analysis. So it's kind of important to realize that science is asking very precise questions about these. And, you know, there's obviously there's uncertainty involved in any kind of scientific study. And that's, you know, always a tricky thing to communicate to readers. And if I knew exactly how to do that, I'd probably have, you know, making a lot more money than I do. But, you know, I think it's important to add that in to say, you know, yes, there's uncertainty involved, but uncertainty doesn't mean we don't know anything. It just means, you know, this is kind of the best we can do with the methods that we have, and that even if there's a small amount of uncertainty, you know, that doesn't negate the finding that, you know, climate change made something more likely or more intense. You just have to, it's a subtle thing to try and communicate to people, and it's difficult, but I think most scientists are pretty good at acknowledging, you know, what the uncertainty is and explaining what that means in terms of the findings. I don't know if that covers.
Yeah, well, maybe if you could also just explain a little bit about how do scientists actually do this? What's their methodology? Just kind of briefly explaining the computer modeling and so forth.
Yeah, so it can depend a little bit. The group that kind of does the most real-time attribution, it's a group out of Oxford. They work with other people in Europe. So they have a bunch of different models that they use, and they do what's called ensembles. So they run the model, you know, dozens of times, so that they have, you know, you don't want just one situation. You want to be able to compare a lot to kind of reduce the uncertainty. So, you know, like I said, they run the model with climate change, without climate change, and compare, you know, either the intensity or the frequency of the event and see how that changes what you see in an event like Hurricane Harvey. So that when they found, you know, that climate change pretty clearly makes events like that more likely. It added to the rainfall there. And then the observations, you can see it's harder for something like storms that are pretty rare events, because obviously if it's a rare event, you're not going to have very many of them in your record to be able to say much about how that's changed, versus heat waves where, you know, we have records often that go back, you know, 150, 200 years, so you can say a lot more about that. And yeah, the more complex an event is, so wildfires, hurricanes, it's a lot harder to say something about that, because there are just so many factors that go into that beyond any kind of climate change signal. You can still look at that. So for a wildfire, you can, if you know that a long heat wave was a component in that, you can examine that component of the wildfire, but you can't say, you know, the wildfire broadly was more, you know, you can't evaluate that on its own.
Great. So we're getting information from scientists as journalists. It's helping us understand the role that climate change is playing in extreme weather events, whether they're storms or heat waves. But then what do you do with that? And so Alex has been, you know, a local news reporter, a daily news reporter. He's now at Huffington Post. He has a lot of experience incorporating climate change and climate science into his stories without necessarily making a story about climate change. So, Alex, would you mind just sharing some of your own advice and thoughts on how you can incorporate climate change and climate science into your daily news reporting pattern?
So, obviously, communicating some of the subtle.
Just, if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself a little bit.
Sure. So, I'm Alexander Kaufman. I'm a reporter at HuffPost. I cover climate policy and environmental policy, you know, often a lot of EPA coverage, especially recently. I thought, just to go off what you were saying, obviously communicating a lot of the subtleties of this attribution science can be a certain type of challenge when you're talking about it for a mainstream audience, as evidenced by the lack of it in so much mainstream coverage of extreme weather events. You know, I think there's been a lot of great research done by Media Matters that demonstrates that lack of coverage, particularly on television. But the way I sort of think of it is that, you know, you wouldn't talk about the sudden death of a celebrity who was known to suffer with diabetes or addiction without mentioning those diseases. You know, you wouldn't talk about the sudden outbreak of a skirmish in eastern Ukraine without talking about the tensions between Ukraine and Russia, right? So it just is an obvious thing that you sort of include. So I thought I would mention three different examples. So last month, I was in Hong Kong during Typhoon Mangkhut, which was the strongest storm this year and the strongest storm to hit Hong Kong since records began in 1946. And when I wrote about it, you know, I, as a step along the way, like reaching out to any other sources that I spoke to for that story, you know, I reached out to a handful of climate scientists, and there are ones who are particularly responsive. In this case, I have to thank Catherine Hayhoe for being wonderful and always picking up the phone, even when we had a 12-hour time difference. And, you know, at the end of the story, she made clear that, you know, this was, you know, this type of weather event fits into the patterns and projections that we can expect from climate change, even if there isn't direct research that shows exactly how much climate change has to do with it, in the way that, say, at the same time, there was that study that came out of Stony Brook about Florence, which was able to connect those dots more clearly. You know, as another example, you know, early in January, when there was a lot of consternation among weather, you know, actual weather scientists about the fact that bomb cyclone was becoming a popular phrase and was likely to lose its actual scientific meaning. I tracked down one of the researchers who helped coin the term, and, you know, did a story sort of talking about what it means for that, you know, specific scientific term to enter into the mainstream and the concerns about the meaning. And, you know, in this larger story that was sort of about a rhetorical phenomenon in the media, obviously I asked him, well, you know, how much does climate change have to do with this? And, you know, we talked at length, and he pointed me to some good studies that I could reference in the article to explain, you know, how you know, winter weather event like this, you know, how that's likely to become more or less frequent as time goes on. And as a final example, I wanted to point to fellow SEJ member Kendra Pierre-Lewis's article from August, where, so we both live in Queens, and, you know, we had been talking about seeing seeing people on Twitter commenting on the on a tornado that touched down in College Point and being horrified, you know, as if this was evidence of some kind of you know, today day after tomorrow scenario already unfolding in New York, and, you know, it was only a matter of time before we only saw the Statue of Liberty's hand sticking out of the ice. So we, you know, she, you know, unlike me who left it at that conversation, she actually talked to some people and wrote a really great piece a couple of days later that talked about how much climate change could be attributed to an event like this. And, you know, the short of it was actually that, you know, we have only had good data on tornadoes starting in 1990, and that before that time, you know, most tornadoes that were reported to the National Weather Service were reported by individuals who saw them. So it's difficult to actually draw any kind of conclusions from that. But again, you know, she talked to other climate scientists who said, well, that is true, and that's important context to this, but this could offer a glimpse of what we might be seeing later in the century more frequently. So I thought that was a really nice example of a story that really succinctly demonstrated the nuances of this while, you know, not getting lost in any of the subtleties.
Now, Alex, you have a much better grasp of climate change and climate science than most policy reporters. You mentioned, you know, the Media Matters research that shows that a lot of other journalists are not talking enough about climate change. In your coverage of storms, then, why don't you lead with the climate change angle? Why isn't that in your headline? Why aren't you telling everybody how important climate change is as your number one priority?
Well, because I think for the but, you know, first of all, for the average reader, you know, I think the concerns about the scope and the threats of a severe weather event are more important. I mean, that whether or not someone might be risking their lives to remain in their homes during a hurricane, or whether they are whether they should listen to other evacuation warnings in a wildfire. I think that is inherently more newsworthy. And, you know, I think that there's always a concern that if you force, certainly there's always room to do that story, and that story that is, here's what climate change means for this event, and that's that. And I think as like a day two story, that's a great one. But, as the main bar story, I think you could unfortunately alienate some readers in a country where, that science is befuddlingly politicized. And I think that you can, you risk misrepresenting the science, with very few exceptions. It's hard when something is initially unfolding to say certainly that there's a causal relationship.
So it's about truthfulness and
accuracy is probably the the concise way I could have answered that.
I hope that you all do check out Alex's coverage of the storm from Hong Kong, because it did do a lovely job of incorporating the climate science angle. It also talked about the resilience issues. It talked about other reasons why storms are worse in, why I think it was the Philippines was affected, more severely than Hong Kong. So he does really an excellent job of incorporating climate change into a story without making climate change the story. If you don't mind, you also cover a lot of politics.
I do.
And, in this country, in Western countries, where I'm in Australia, England, it's very politicized.
Yeah.
How can you incorporate climate change into political coverage without making it like just a plain dichotomy between
sure.
yes and no, right and wrong?
Well, I mean, I think the more interesting way to look at it is to sort of try to seek, obviously I'm speaking to a very specific type of coverage of climate politics in this sense, but for me, I think the most interesting area of climate coverage is in candidates or officials or political actors who are attempting to devise policies or propose policies that are actually tethered to the increasingly bleak warnings that scientists are putting out there. And, unfortunately, in this country, but in many Western countries, I wouldn't say Canada or other places is above this, that, the Overton window of what is considered, like, acceptable discourse for potential policy solutions is very small. I mean, like, in the United States, on one end you have a Republican like Carlos Curbelo, who proposes a revenue-neutral carbon tax, and on the other end you have the great hawkish Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, whose proposal is also a revenue-neutral carbon tax. Mm-hmm. And, there are, I think, a particularly exciting area of political proposals has been in some of these candidates who are now talking about things that are, represent much more severe interventions into the larger economy to decarbonize, and there's a lot of talk about things like a Green New Deal and having stronger green fiscal stimulus to support 100% renewable energy goals. And frankly, I think that talking about those things, which could actually potentially make a difference in greenhouse gas emissions from the country, as opposed to things that, could subtly tweak things at a time when we're talking about all of these potentially, potential accelerating events in the next few decades, is more exciting and a little bit more honest if the goal is to actually communicate to readers, this is a way that we could potentially avert some of the worst effects of climate change by the end of the century.
And so clearly, as a pretty broad rule, Democrats have better climate policies than Republicans. So why, when I read your work, are you not nicer to the Democratic the Democratic Party and its climate policies?
Well, I mean, I think what I said before, it clearly kind of illustrates the lack of ideas in that party that are, again, tethered to the scientific realities that are coming out. I mean, we're about to have this IPCC report come out in a day, and if you're going to tell me that like a slight revenue neutral carbon tax, that is, at $50 per metric ton of CO2 instead of $24 per metric ton of CO2, and that is going to help us stay within 1.5 degrees of warming, I'd like to buy you a drink and really hear how that actually can play out. So I mean, Kate Aronoff, who's a climate writer, usually for The Intercept, she's actually working on a new book right now that I think will be out next year that's about the new denialism, which sort of identifies this, these types of liberal policies, ostensibly, that are meant to deal with climate change, but are still essentially denying the realities of how quickly we need to decarbonize if we truly intend to stay within a certain amount of warming. So, I guess the short answer is it seems like a lot of Democrats are denying those scientific realities as well, just in a slightly different way.
Right. Thanks, Alex. And very excited to have Justine Kalmer joining us from GRIST.
Thanks, John.
Justine does really extraordinary work around the environmental justice, and so if you don't mind just explaining your work, some of your stories and your background, and talk about how you incorporate climate change into your coverage.
Sure. So I actually transitioned from being a community organizer to being a journalist. And so some of that background carries over into my work. I'm also an immigrant from the Philippines, and so I have grown up and still, whenever there's another typhoon, I have to check and see how that might impact my family or community. But I cover now environmental justice and health for GRIST, which is an environmental news outlet online. And what does that mean, though, environmental justice? It's something that's growing, and basically what I'm going to be talking about today is the suffering part in the name of the workshop. And John, you mentioned, why was Typhoon Mangkhut, why did it have a bigger toll in the Philippines than say in Hong Kong? And I've covered climate change in both Hong Kong and in the Philippines, and just off the bat, one of the biggest differences that you have in both of those regions is going to be poverty. And then you're also going to have the lack of infrastructure, strong infrastructure in the Philippines, and then you're also going to have the history of deforestation and coal extraction that has made the ground really unstable. And then you have things like landslides that increase the death toll after a storm like that. So I look at these marginalized communities, how they're disproportionately affected. They're often called frontline communities. So commonly women, working class or poor communities, communities of color, indigenous peoples are usually folks who are on the front lines. For me, what it really boils down to is that climate change isn't happening within a vacuum, right? It's happening within our societies, and they exacerbate the existing inequities in those societies. And so, for example, when it comes to hurricanes or typhoons, one of the things that I've looked at quite a bit is how women are uniquely affected, both in Puerto Rico and then in the Philippines as well. One of the biggest things that you'll find after any disaster, this is true in conflict and it's true after something as devastating as Haiyan or Maria, is that there's an uptick in gender-based violence. So sexual assault, rape, human trafficking. When I talked with aid workers in Puerto Rico, I wasn't in Puerto Rico actually, I was reporting from New York. But when I talked with aid workers who were there, they talked with me about how they were concerned about, hearing reports from women who had been assaulted. They were concerned about the blackouts, how that was going to affect women's safety. It's something, and I think that's something that we're still going to be seeing in the long term. There's not necessarily, I think, numbers on that just yet, just the kind of anecdotal side of it. But there are, you know, this is documented in cases, say, after Typhoon Katrina. There was a national fund that was started because of sexual assault and human trafficking out of certain evacuation shelters there. And they were, last year, that fund was run dry because they had to work in Texas, and then they had to deal with Irma, and then they had to deal with Maria. And one of the reasons why that happens is you look at how women are displaced or separated from loved ones during storms. There's a breakdown of infrastructure, communications, and accountability and support for women. And then you also have tensions that are very high. And you know, to be clear, sexual assault and rape is it's a product of power. It's not about you know, attraction or things like that. It has to do with power. And when you have a situation where folks are feeling very powerless, or other people are there, and there's a great power disparity between people who are affected and those who aren't, then that's a recipe for a lot of vulnerability. And then I also looked at, I went to the Philippines 3 years after Typhoon Haiyan, and I was looking at the rise in sex trafficking after the storm. And it was really, really startling because I actually started my reporting in a sex tourism district in the Philippines, and many of the women who worked in the bars and brothels there were from Tacloban, the region that was most affected by Haiyan. And women told me that after the storm, Angeles, which is that sex tourism hotspot, was like Tacloban because so many women came there after the storm. Recruiters specifically went there and offered scholarships or jobs, and then, you know, that obviously turned out to be false, and women were then stuck in these, you know, in these situations. And it's something that aid agencies at the Philippine government and the United Nations have all begun to address, is how climate change has become a push factor for things like trafficking and obviously and migration as well, which comes with its own vulnerabilities. The local social workers that I talked with, they documented as well a rise in the number of human trafficking cases that they addressed post right after the storm. And those numbers are obviously super underreported. And then they're doing things now like building evacuation shelters that are going to be safer places for women. They have clear sight lines throughout, so there's like fewer places that someone can be taken and you know, you won't see what's happening. The bathrooms kind of have almost like a mesh so that they're not soundproof. You can kind of hear outside, and you know, separate wash facilities. And they actually train first responders in recognizing human trafficking. The other thing that was really stark to me as well, when you look at who's really vulnerable during and after a storm, are people with disabilities. I did some reporting on efforts to make New York City's emergency response more accessible for people with disabilities after Hurricane Sandy. And I spoke with a woman who uses an electric wheelchair, and she lived in an area that was evacuated, and she could not get to the evacuation bus because she couldn't get down the stairs, and the elevators were out, so she couldn't use the elevator. The evacuation bus left her. She was left in her apartment for days, and eventually her electric wheelchair also ran out of juice, so then at that point she was pretty much bedridden. And she was so upset. She was a really strong advocate, and 5 years later, however, she still felt she still feels unsafe if there's to be another, you know, God forbid, another similar disaster. I also spoke with a family in the Philippines who had a son with developmental disabilities and who also used the wheelchair, and they were unable to get to a shelter, so they basically rode out the storm in, like, lodged between two large boulders, and just rode it out. And now, actually, they live nearby that new shelter that's designed to be more gender responsive, but also wheelchair accessible too. So those are some of the things to look for that I look for when it comes to the storm. And then I didn't report on this, but in Florence, there were the two mental health patients that died in a van. They were restrained in a van, and responders weren't able to get to them in time. But you know, these are all things to be thinking about. Parents as well, who talk about what kinds of needs their children might have once they're in a shelter, and then oftentimes if the shelter isn't accessible, then these folks can be taken to institutions that where they are unable to live as independent of a life that you know, that they normally have, and then it can actually become really difficult for a person with a disability to leave that institution once they've been placed there. So that's a problem too. And then recently this summer, I've been reporting on urban heat islands, so looking at extreme heat, which is a super overlooked aspect of climate change. And even though it is one of the easiest things to tie to climate change from a scientific aspect, and it's also the extreme heat, I'm sorry, it's also the extreme weather event that kills the most Americans every year. Then, you know, more than storms or you know, other events, it's actually extreme heat that's the deadliest. And when you look at places like New York City, I'm also from Queens, but when you look at places like New York City, you have something called the urban heat island effect, which is there are literally places that are hotter than the surrounding areas because of the built environment. So cities are often hotter than their rural counterparts. Much of that has to do with the way that dark pavements trap heat, the way buildings with dark rooftops trap heat, the lack of green space, greenery, which helps to cool down the environment as well. So cities are already warmer than the rural counterparts. And then within a city, you have micro urban heat islands or hot spots, which are places that, you know, typically border industry or have had a history of disinvestment. So there hasn't been a lot of money put into making public parks and things like that. And so who's going to live there, right? Most of the time, you're going to have low-income communities of color in these urban heat islands, and so they're disproportionately going to be feeling that heat and the health effects of that heat. And you also have here, because it's usually neighborhoods that border industry, you're going to have folks that also tend to have a higher rates of asthma or lung disease, and that actually makes them more susceptible to heat-related illness as well, because the heat can trigger someone's asthma. It can trigger an asthma attack, things like that. And in New York City, the city sees an average of 100 heat-related deaths every year just within the city. And of those 100 deaths, roughly half of them are African Americans, even though African Americans are only 25% of the general population in New York. They represent close to half of those heat-related deaths. And so so those are some of the ways in which it's important to look at, you know, how climate change is affecting a community, but also how it's working in concert with these other, you know, systemic inequities, right? Whether it has to do with race, gender, ability, all of these things. And I would say, given that GRIST is a solutions-based, we do a lot of solutions-based reporting. And so I also look a lot into that it's really important that solutions, if they aren't addressing those inequities and also aren't inclusive or led by those communities that are most affected, that they're often not really solutions. Or there's, you know, build solutions but are leaving certain folks behind. And then lastly, like, you know, we're talking about the climate science here, but for me, when it comes to covering these environmental justice stories, it's just as important to respect the disciplines in academia of critical race theory, of ethnic studies and gender studies, because that also provides a lot of context to why, you know, why certain groups may be suffering the most, or why they may have solutions that are really important but may not be being heard. Yeah.
Great. So I have just one question before we open it up to the audience. But, you know, talking about your work in the Philippines after Haiyan, you know, it seems that the relationship between climate change and sex trafficking and suffering is an indirect one. You see a relationship mm-hmm. between climate change and the storm, and you see a relationship between the storm and the sex trafficking. How do you then draw that connection in your coverage between climate change and the human impacts, given that it's indirect?
Right. I hear you. And so... oftentimes, I mean, a lot of it is in the language, right? Like, there's a lot of, you know, the use of the term threat multiplier or push factor. And so I lean on the experts in that realm. Push factor is, it's language that's used when it comes to folks who work on migration and trafficking. And so, it's, you know, it's not the cause of why this is happening, but it's something that's adding to the problem.
Great. Thank you, Justine. So we'll open up to questions. I've been told to prioritize SEJ members and journalists first, but if you have a question, just throw your hand up. And
hi, I'm Teresa Brain. I'm a freelance journalist, and for 7 years I worked in Indian Country Today, the old version. But I was at a recent climate panel covering climate change, and it talked about people who don't evacuate and how they're often vilified for, you know, hanging in there and not listening to instructions. And a lot of the time they don't have a car and can't leave, and they're unable to evacuate. And so then they're doubly victimized because they have to be rescued, but they also are blamed. So I was wondering if any of you could speak to that.
Yeah, let's see if Alex, do you, would you like to just... So the question was, when people don't evacuate, we tend to blame them for their own suffering thereafter. Alex, how would you advise handling something like that?
Don't. I mean, you know, I think if you're going to go into reporting on, you know, like, absolute calamity in a community... operating under the assumption that human beings are always rational and always do the rational thing and always listen to those warnings that they're getting. I don't think that's a very humane way of approaching a subject, particularly someone whose life has just been thrown into total turmoil. And secondly, I mean, I would say that you can look beyond that and look at what the issues are with the, you know, communication infrastructure from authorities and just the overall infrastructure in the place that they live. So, I mean, looking at, Hong Kong is obviously a particular place for a number of reasons, both because it's extraordinarily wealthy and it's, you know, has a unique style of government, particularly compared to, like, a U.S. state. It's also very small. But, you know, that... is, compared to parts of the United States where I've reported on these things before, you know, all of the services are remarkably centered around its observatory and responsive to the warnings that come from that. And so, you know, there are easier ways of forcing people into things. And in a more spread out, you know, rural environment, you know, my colleague, Christy Angelo, who's here in the audience, did some really fantastic coverage out of North Carolina during Florence, you know, and it's simply not the same type of environment. You know, there are people all over the place. There are people who don't, you know, they're getting warnings from TV meteorologists who they don't necessarily always trust and who they associate with sometimes getting forecasts wrong. And, you know, there isn't the same type of infrastructure for them to go to and feel like they can reliably evacuate to and have comfortable conditions in that makes it seem like that is the best possible choice. So I
thanks. Yeah. And then just what are some of the reasons that people might not evacuate?
Oh, there's so many reasons, right, that people have, you know, and many times valid mistrust of authority. I also did some reporting on immigrant communities, how there can be a lot of fear, especially for immigrant communities when it comes to FEMA knocking at your door, because, you know, FEMA is also underneath the Department of Homeland Security, and so there's been fear about FEMA sharing information with ICE, you know, the folks are at times afraid that they could either expose their own immigration status or that of a family member. And so that's been a really difficult challenge when it comes to evacuating folks in immigrant communities. There are also, you know, barriers in communication. Like, for example, when there's a heat threat in New York City, the city has upped its social media and kind of online alerts for people, telling them to, and actually people need to leave their apartments because oftentimes it's hotter inside your apartment than it is outside. So people need to leave. But the people who actually get stranded in their apartments and are more likely to become ill or die from that are older folks, elderly people. They're not on Twitter. And they're, you know, generally not checking for alerts online. So now the city is partnering with community-based organizations to actually knock on people's doors. But there's a lot to be said around how, you know, how authorities are cognizant of their relationship to the community, and how they can better access folks.
Thank you. So, yeah, some people just can't evacuate. They don't have the money, don't have a car, or whatever. Another question? Sure. Sure. So the question is about volcanoes, earthquakes, and tsunamis. Andrea, is there a relationship between any of those phenomena and climate change?
Yeah. So there is a little bit of research on that. There can be in some instances. So, I don't know that they necessarily tied climate change in specifically, but if you have, say, if you have, you know, a drought or flooding or something like that that is changing the amount of water in the land near a fault, that can change the pressure on the fault. So there is some indication that that could play a role. I don't think that there's any kind of formal attribution studies sort of linking earthquakes to those kinds of causes yet. But I know that there have been, you know, studies looking at the possibility of that. And that would, I would assume, include volcanoes too, if you have those kinds of pressures being changed by something like water. Landslides are probably a lot easier to tie in, because if you have a landslide or a mudslide caused by flooding, and that flooding is happening more frequently from climate change, that's much easier to tie in, and I know that's been a big concern too.
Thanks, Andrea.
Mm-hmm.
Andy?
Sorry. And Andy Rutkin, National Geographic Society, New York Times, et cetera. But I mean, you're writing about this stuff, and it's great to see, well, everything you're doing is great. And the focus on vulnerability is great. What I would ask you about is whether you feel that you have found, let me see, I'll just make a statement. Everything has been talked about virtually in terms of what we care about as news people is impacts, vulnerability, climate vulnerability. And I would encourage everyone in the room, when you're approaching a climate change rhetoric, to say, what am I really reporting about? What just happened in Haiyan? Mm-hmm. Seth Bornstein did a really important story on Haiyan, where he looked at the demographics, too. So talk to a demographer, not just a climate scientist, and the geography. Tacloban.
Uh-huh.
The population quadrupled in 40 years. Mm-hmm. So if that same typhoon had hit that town, the city, 40 years ago, it would have been like a snooze of a story, you know, from the outside world's perspective, a disaster still. And that section of the Philippines is this, you know, it's like Typhoon Alley. Right? Mm-hmm. So what changed? What's the thing that changed? You know, and I find myself having to do almost like calisthenics. You know, stepping back from the, you know, I've been writing about climate change, it matters for 30 years. But stepping back from that, saying, what am I looking at right now? And what do I know? And then you say, talk to a geographer, not just a climate scientist. Talk to a, and then you get to solutions. When you talk to a climate scientist, ask them, what would climate policy do to the situation? When you think about solutions, it's all on the ground. It's nothing about climate policy because of inertia will change any outcome in any place that we care about for decades. Decades to come. Yeah. What's happening in those decades? Ask yourselves those questions. And then you come up with all these stories. Like, why isn't Jerry Brown talking about zoning and wildfire zones? When he just is talking about global warming, he's Kate Aronoff should. I hope there's a chapter on that. It's not just the solutions denial, it's the reality denial. Mm-hmm. That if we're not talking about why are people building in wildfire zones, when we could change that, that's a really good story. And they're all over the place. And then when the Philippine government blames climate change, it's a cop-out because they're not focusing on development and where are we putting our homeless people and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah, totally. It is all of these historic systems that have pushed people to certain areas that tend to be more vulnerable and also tend to have less political power. Mm-hmm. The Philippines is really interesting because that Typhoon Alley that you're talking about, Tacloban, it Region 8, the Visayas, is... So the Philippines is an archipelago of 7,000 islands. It was a colony of Spain and then a colony of the U.S. The Spanish established the seat of power in the north and the current capital of Manila, and everyone south has felt sort of marginalized by what they call Imperial Manila. So the Visayas, you know, is it's considered, like, the language is considered a minority. The interesting part about that, and you know, you're talking about how the demographics, the politics, the history of a place all comes into play with climate change. The current president, Duterte, he actually part of his popularity came from he wasn't from Imperial Manila. He also was super popular in areas that were devastated by typhoons because he was seen as like one of the first mayors to arrive and respond to Haiyan. And I'm not giving him any climate credits because he's also expanding coal in the country. But all of these issues tie into each other into why a certain population is going to be highly vulnerable.
Thanks. And Andy raised some really excellent points around context and climate change. One thing he did emphasize that I just want to say one thing about is he talked about the importance of not just talking to a climate scientist, also talking to a geographer. I've been covering a lot of wildfires lately. I can tell you, talk to a climate scientist, they'll say climate change is responsible for the worsening of the wildfire situation. You talk to a forestry scientist, they have a different bias. They're gonna be talking about issues of forest management and so forth. So you want to be talking to a variety of scientists. I know we don't all have a lot of scientists in our Rolodexes, but I just wanted to say there's a new service from AAAS, the American, I don't know, science, whatever.
American Association for the Advancement of Science.
Thank you, Andrea. They have a new service called SciLine, SciLine. If you Google them, Twitter, whatever, you let them know what you're working on, they will get you some sources that they've already vetted. So that's one way that you can get that diversity into your in the back here.
I'm wondering, because I'm looking again at causal relationships, we're at the nearing the low end of the solar cycle. And every once in a while I read about solar cycle connections with weather and the low solar cycle will cool things up. The higher end of the solar cycle, the electrification, will warm things. And I'm having some people who I suspect may be deniers try to pull the solar cycle one. And I'm wondering, I mean, often things are in shades of gray. I'm wondering what.
So I think the question is really related to what's the relationship between the sun and solar phases and changing temperatures and changing climate. And Andrea, if you could speak to that, please.
Yep. So that those do have an impact on global temperatures and climate, but there have been numerous studies done to show that the effect is nowhere close to what greenhouse gases are doing. It's so much smaller. So it may have been more of an issue in millennia past, but right now what's causing the warming is greenhouse gases. And there are, I can't think of, individual studies off the top of my head, but I know that there have been a lot done. And it's kind of one of these whack-a-mole denier theories that kind of just resurfaces and resurfaces. And it's an issue because, it's no matter how many times it's pointed out that, like, no, we've looked at this. This is not the cause. It just kind of keeps coming back up, and how you deal with that, I don't know.
So it's true that there's a relationship between solar phases and on a very long time frame, there is a relationship between climate and issues related to the sun, but it's not the case that that's what's warming.
You can directly tie, the rate that warming is happening now is very clearly because of the rate that greenhouse gases have changed in a very, very short amount of time.
So for everybody in the room who's, just covering climate change as a part of their stories, can they just ignore the influence of the solar cycle?
Yes.
Thank you.
don't
worry
about
it. Let's go in the middle this time.
Stephanie with BBC News in Washington. I wanted to ask about wildfires exactly, because talking to a variety of scientists sounds great. Sometimes they are time-consuming to find and interview, and my editors don't like to wait that long. The other thing that I've run into with this recent cycle is people in Washington, who I cover with very large microphones, discount an entire area of science, and all of a sudden the researchers don't want to talk to me anymore.
The researchers don't want to talk to you because of what?
Because the Trump has been just tweeting about it.
Yeah, sure. So recently, President Trump and Interior Secretary Zinke have been saying some very confusing and baffling and fundamentally incorrect things about the wildfires. They've been kind of denying the fact that there's a relationship between climate change and the wildfires. I think it was Zinke. Zinke has been proposing doing more logging, so basically get rid of the forest to get rid of the forest fire problem.
And yeah.
Right. So it has been very confusing. And the question from Stephanie is that because it's become politicized, she has difficulties talking to researchers and scientists because they don't want to be drawn into this kind of ridiculous anti-science spat. So I'm wondering if, Andrea, perhaps you could offer some advice for how you can build trust with researchers so that they will talk to you despite what's happening in the federal political climate.
Yeah, that's a hard one. And then, in general, I think it's easier to get scientists that are part of academia versus government scientists. Yeah, so, and that's going to be kind of tricky. I would say, if you wanted to talk to a government scientist and they are kind of reluctant, you can always ask them, is there someone in academia you work with that would be able to, talk to me like you are, that isn't concerned about, their job potentially. That's one thing I've done. There are definitely some scientists that, are not as worried about that. And, you can see a lot of them talk on Twitter. So anyone that's talking on Twitter is probably not going to worry about being quoted in the media since they're talking publicly. That's kind of a barometer I use. And I think if you're, clear to them that, you're just trying to get the science right, and make sure you give the context and explain it correctly, and that you're not, pitting them against what the president is saying, reassuring them.
What I've run into is that some of them just, they know why I'm asking, and they're like, I don't want any part of this.
Yeah.
The other thing that I've run into that I'm curious your thoughts on is I do use Twitter a lot to find scientists, and I find it really helpful, but then those voices start being repeated everywhere, and I want to make sure I'm getting a variety of perspectives.
Yeah, so the question is how to get a variety of perspectives. I think the Sci-Line that John mentioned is a good example, and I know there are a couple, and I can't remember off the top of my head the organizations that are doing them, but they're specifically geared towards helping journalists find more women scientists to comment, and then some on more scientists of color to kind of help diversify, because you definitely do end up with a lot of the same people. So I think those are good resources, especially to kind of when you're under a time crunch.
And if I could just add, so it just got mentioned very briefly, but there's also a group called 500 Women Scientists,
yes,
which is a fantastic resource for finding scientists, to quote in your stories, who are not necessarily white men. We can go to the back here.
Yeah, thanks. This is a great event. I'm Rich Glassy, freelance journalist. I have a question along the lines of the solar question. I think the scientists—it's kind of a great turning point. We're at the point where scientists are getting more confident about attribution. But I think they really struggled with natural system oscillation variation. I read this book by Mark Cerise on Arctic. It just took a long time to understand Arctic amplification oscillation. So these scientists that are warning us about systems shifting and the dangers—they still are. Were reluctant about attributing individual events. And I was wondering how you take into account and how you convey oscillations, natural variations, El Nino, Arctic amplification, etc.
So the question is, there are natural climate cycles. There's decades-long ocean cycles. There's El Nino, La Nina. How do you discuss that in a story in addition to climate change? And Andrew, you're probably best to answer this one.
So in terms of, the attribution studies that are done for individual events, the models and observations certainly would kind of already have that included in, because those have been going on while all those, that history is happening. And models do, to varying extents, take those into account. They're baked into the models. It is a little tricky. Those are, the atmosphere is an enormously complex system, and I think asking if there's a specific event that you're curious about, asking the scientist directly, okay, well, are you taking El Nino into account? Are you taking the Arctic oscillation into account? Various things like that, just asking them, is this being kind of considered as part of that? I don't know that we're at the point yet where we can say pick up an event apart and say, X percent is due to El Nino, X percent is due to climate change. That is really difficult to do, and not every model is as good at replicating those things. Yeah. And Andy helpfully cued me, the paleoclimate record is also a really good indicator.
What is that?
Paleoclimate. So that's, looking at the history of the Earth's climate and things like sediment cores, ice cores, things like that. We can get an idea of how those natural oscillations have changed over time, and how they impacted the climate when they were in various periods.
And you talk to some good scientists, they will incorporate all of these different issues into their explanations to you as to why something is happening the way that it's happening. Mm-hmm. More questions? Let's go to the back.
Can you repeat, Andrea, the name and date of the study that was the breakthrough in terms of attribution, and talk a little bit more about what changed? Why did it take so long to get to this point of attribution?
Just if you could repeat it. So the question...
So the question was to talk a little bit more about that first attribution study and why it took so long to get to that point.
This is the Florence, right?
Well, I think you were asking about, is it the 2003, on the 2003 heat wave one that I mentioned?
The one that you mentioned.
Oh. Yeah, okay. So that was Peter Stott at the UK Met Office did that in 2004, and it specifically looked at the 2003 European heat waves. And showed how much, I can't remember if it was, looked at likelihood and intensity. I don't know, Andy, if you remember if it was both of those, or if it was just one or the other, but Peter Stott, STOTT. and he's still incredibly active in that field. So I think a lot of what happened to get to that point was you had to have models that could be run quickly enough and that had the kind of resolution to be able to pick apart events like that. So, you know, the finer detail that models can look at, the easier it is to be able to do these kind of attribution studies, because these kinds of events happen on very, you know, regional and local timescales. And if you have a climate model that's looking at the whole globe, you know, picking those apart, it's not always going to have that fine detail that you want. And so it was really the advance in computer models,
So let me just take a step back, and you've probably seen some of the computers that they crunch the data on. Would you mind just describing how powerful, how enormous these things are?
Yeah, I mean, these are the kind of, you know, the supercomputers that, you know, take up whole rooms, that kind of thing. This is enormous computing power, and it takes, you know, it takes a long time to run these. And you know, the reason we're being able to, you know, do this faster and in finer detail is because computing power is increasing. So we can have more detail and run them faster than we were able to in the past.
Thanks, Andrew. Now, this fellow's been trying to ask a question for a long time. So,
we also have a question over here.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could address the issue of research and the political chill on research. Obviously, scientists are more and more reluctant to speak out. I wonder how that has specifically maybe impacted the progress of the research going on in this area and so forth.
Just repeat the question.
Yeah, so the question was how, you know, the current political environment and some of the, you know, the chill around science has impacted the research. There was a lot of concern about that, and I actually talked to a lot of scientists right after the election, right after the inauguration, to kind of get what some of their concerns were. And there were a few concerns. You know, there was obviously concerns about funding in the federal government. Organizations that do a lot of this, like NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, does a lot of work with climate models, NASA as well. There was a concern that you'd have a brain drain. You'd have graduate students not wanting to stay in climate change because funding was uncertain, and this was a field where they feel a lot of pressure and, you know, that had a lot of political rancor to it. There's also a lot of concern with a lot of our observational efforts, so satellites, things like that, because the only reason we can say what's happening with climate change is because we have the observations to show that it's happening. And if something happens, if a satellite that is key to getting those with some of the satellites that observe Arctic sea ice are, and that are currently kind of on their last legs, you can't get those observations back, you know, so having a gap in observations. Those were kind of the three main areas. I would say, you know, with funding so far, Congress has done a pretty good job of kind of protecting a lot of that funding. It hasn't really come to pass the kind of worst fears. And part of that's because you have a lot of congressional leaders who realize the importance. You have a lot of them who have, you know, these NOAA and NASA facilities in their districts, so they want to protect them. I would say, a lot of researchers are just kind of keeping their heads down, even in the government. And, you know, a lot of that research isn't getting as much attention right now from the administration. It's just not what they are paying the most attention to. You know, on the environmental side, I think most of it's happening around the EPA and kind of more air pollution, water pollution issues than anything climate related. Now, it may be that when reports come out, the administration doesn't trumpet them like previous administrations might have, but so far it's not being held back. So I think the concerns are still there, but, you know, so far it hasn't seemed to have too big an impact. So
it sounds like basic science is being somewhat protected, but then the administration is, you know, trying to silence or ignore the science.
Yeah, I think so far it's been more ignore than any direct silencing. There's been a little bit, depending on the department. And
thanks, Andrea. And so the question over here?
It's more of a comment. Hi, I'm Deborah Kroll, Indigenous journalist. I'm going to give you all away one of my secrets if you're looking for people who are pretty free and open to comment. That would be the Institute of Tribal Environmental Professionals at Northern Arizona University.
Sorry, just the Institute?
Institute of Tribal Environmental Professionals.
And in what circumstances would reporters reach out to this group?
Because they can help connect you with both scientists and on the ground workers in the area of environmental protection, addressing climate change, species protections, who are either, you know, working with tribes or are tribal members. They connected me with Dr. Ian Kusops, who is a Maori marine biologist who's using both his scientific knowledge and his Maori culture to preserve crayfish, you know, known as the koura. And in fact, you guys might want to look to New Zealand, because a lot of those scientists are starting to dual write their papers in the Maori language. And so the other thing is I haven't heard anything about the ties between what we call tech, traditional ecological knowledge, and those people who are working with Western scientists to merge that. So is anyone here in their panel doing that? Because it seems that it is a growing field, but most non-native journalists don't seem to know about it.
That's something I would love to do more reporting on and haven't yet. But yes, Indigenous peoples are on the front lines all over the world, and also are stewards of so much knowledge, as you said, and have been really innovative in solutions as well. I mean, I spoke with there was an Indigenous community in Indonesia that was building drones that to do some kind of like mapping and assessment of their land. There are tons of, and then there's more like traditional knowledge as well, because folks have been stewarding the land for
millennia.
Generations.
Millennia.
Yeah.
Thank you. Question here.
So I'm on 20 and 25%. Sorry, I'm Eduardo Franco, investigative reporter from Bolivia. I'm on 20 and 25% of greenhouses are caused by deforestation. A research published by the American Meteorological Society concluded that deforestation in the Amazon rainforest can result in 20% of precipitation reduction for the coastal Northwest and the Sierra Nevada in the U.S. So my question is, what's your experience and advice on writing about the drivers of climate change?
And so the question is fundamentally about deforestation and the relationship between deforestation and, I guess, global climate change, but also weather conditions. Andrew, is this something that you could talk to, any advice on? I think the question about how to drivers of
climate
deforestation.
Change. Yeah, of deforestation, I guess, climate change in general, or?
More related to the U.S., we're talking about 20% of reduction in the precipitation in the Sierra Nevada and the coastal Northwest.
So why don't you talk about the relationship between deforestation and climate change, I think.
Yeah, and I know that's a really big, you know, I mean, there's so many active areas of climate research, but that's definitely a big one. So it's one.
Well, why does deforestation have any kind of role in climate change?
So basically, deforestation reduces the amount of carbon that those forests are, we call it sequestering, basically that they're sucking up as they grow and storing in the soils and in their plant mass, and so that means that you have, you know, they're not taking up all that excess CO2 that we're spewing into the atmosphere is basically what's happening. So it's sort of a, I guess not indirect, but you know, they're not directly contributing to emissions. They just mean that we're not being able to reduce the emissions as much as we might want to.
So deforestation has a role in climate change globally, but what about local weather conditions and rainfall and so forth?
Yeah, so, you know, forested areas definitely play a role in local climate too. They, you know, they impact the water cycle, the hydrological cycle, so they influence how much moisture is in the atmosphere, which has effects on rainfall. They also mediate local temperatures a bit. Forests are cooler than typically the unforested area around, especially as just you mentioned, the built environment. So it's kind of both global and local.
And some of the reasons for deforestation include, you know, clearing land for agriculture, clearing land for planting the trees that produce the, what is that, the product that goes into everything in Indonesia and so forth.
The viscose?
Palm oil.
And viscose too. Yeah.
And so there's a whole bunch of reasons why, in the U.S., in the Southeast, we have a huge... It's basically the American South is almost a tree farm. You know, it's like we use it for paper and for wood products and so forth. More questions?
Just kind of a follow up question to that. So let's say you are covering a story about wildfires. How many steps back do you go? Like, you're in the wildfires. Climate change makes the wildfires worse. Well, there's less rain because of climate change, which makes the wildfires. And why is there less rain? Because deforestation in the Amazon. And why is there deforestation? Well, it's because of agriculture, all the reasons you said. You can't get everything in every story.
No.
So how do you cut yourself off?
And just identify yourself if you don't
I'm Anna Groves, I'm at Discover Magazine.
So the question is, so there's so much complexity in climate change, there's so much going on in the environment, there's so much science around that. How do you then kind of take all of that information and condense it down into a form that's actually useful for your story? And I'm wondering if, Alex, you might be able to talk to that one.
Sure. I don't think that there's any one answer. I think it depends on the type of story that you're telling. I mean, if the story is specifically about the role that climate change has played in this wildfire, I think it depends on your audience, but I would be as exhaustive as you can be and still have it be understandable to a reader that doesn't have a science background. But, if you are, putting two paragraphs in a larger story about a news event, I probably wouldn't trace it back too far. I would probably find one or two good studies that illustrate those things and link to them so that, a reader who's curious and wants to investigate more can do so.
So that's a useful perspective from a kind of a day-to-day news approach. But, Andrew, what about when you're writing for, like, Discover Magazine is... Yeah, so what about when you're writing a more of a science feature where science is a part of the story? How do you take all of that information, make it relevant, make it interesting without going over the top?
It's very similar story to story. If I'm writing about a specific attribution study that's been done, I'm kind of focusing more in on that than I am necessarily going back, tracing. All these different contributors to global warming. I usually try, I think in most of my stories, I say that greenhouse gases are rising without necessarily getting into all of the reasons why. I typically point out fossil fuels because that is the main contributor and that's the one that I think is most important. Sometimes... It depends so much on the story, what area you're writing about, how easy it is to link different causes to different things, and how relevant. If you're dealing with a story about climate change in South America, you're probably more likely to want to bring up deforestation in the Amazon and something like that because it's kind of more regionally relevant.
Yeah, great. And Justine, in your coverage, you have so much going on. You have there's so much complexity. You're talking about real human impacts and human experiences and suffering and injustice. How then do you, when you're dealing with an event that's influenced by climate change, how do you take this enormous mass, this enormous body of science, and incorporate that into your coverage?
I'll generally try to incorporate at least one brick of science somewhere in the story or in a way that hopefully doesn't, weigh down the rest, the narrative, but also balances all of these other issues that are at play. But I do think that it's really important. I mean, I don't think you can really grapple with the problem unless you name it. So I do try to at least, and also because... When you say human trafficking and climate change, most people's reaction is like, "What?" And so, if I don't have the science in there, people won't take the whole thing seriously, so I do have to make sure that I'm very clear about the evidence that's there.
Great. So I think we've got time for one more question, if there's one from the audience, somebody who hasn't asked a question yet, or are we exactly exhausted? Oh, here we go.
For Andrea, when do you change the model? When does it start to evolve when you're doing that kind of science?
When do the models change, and when you're doing this kind of science, attribution science, they're constantly evolving. You know, these models are constantly being tweaked and improved to include more aspects of the climate system, to do that more accurately with more complexity. You know, there are several. One of the big area, one of the big units that does it is the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory in Princeton, New Jersey. It's part of NOAA, and they're kind of one of the forefront. The UK Met Office also does a lot of work like that, and these things, they're constantly improving them. So it's kind of not we have this new model, we're turning it on. It's an iterative process.
So it's coding, right? It's software. It's constantly...
Yeah, without getting too into the details of how they do it.
How do you attribute that any coverage to that model if it's constantly changed?
I don't know that I really get into that too much unless the story is kind of specifically about, an advancement in attribution. There's every year there's the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society puts out a big issue that is all attribution studies, and so in a story like that, I might acknowledge, that they're approving this constantly, but in kind of average stories, I typically don't get into that because it's kind of tangential, and I have more important things. I feel like I want to get into the story than that. But yeah, I do, directly kind of talking about attribution science, they're constantly approving this.
Thank you, Andrew. So thanks, everybody, but particularly thanks to these panelists for making their time.